Alexa, open Brave Words Radio.
Welcome back to Brave Words Radio, brought to you by Vox Protocol, the global leader in voice app entertainment. Brave Words Radio is an awesome musical extension of bravewords.com, where we have been waving the flag of hard rock and heavy metal around the world for over 30 years. Since you have been here before, we hope you enjoy Brave Words Radio.
So please welcome to Streaming for Vengeance, Brave Words Streaming for Vengeance, Mr. Wolf Hoffman from Accept. Great to have you, sir.
How's it going, my man?
I'm doing well. The last time we actually crossed paths was on 70,000 tons of metal.
Oh, many moons ago.
Well, many moons ago. Yeah, like three years ago. They actually kind of snuck that cruise in because literally it was a couple of weeks after that the whole world shut down, right?
No, I think our cruise, wasn't it a bit earlier than that? I can't remember for sure. I mean, this whole last couple of years, they just sort of evaporated on us, haven't they? They're just erased from my memory in a way.
it's a good thing, but I can't imagine being, and you weren't the only band, but to spend all this money and time and effort to put a record out, which, I mean, you guys aren't a young band, so to putting out a record is a big deal. And then right. Just had to sit on it. Like, what a financial expense, what a, like, a mind, you know what.
Yeah, but at the same time, it was, our album was done, and we were ready, and we wanted to people to hear it. I mean, it would have been even weirder to just hold it back and wait for the best time to release it, because nobody knew when that was going to be. So we decided, let's go ahead, even though it's in the middle of a pandemic, but at least fans can enjoy new music, and then when the times get better, we come out and tour and present it to the world. And here we are. This is now.
And here we are. And how excited are you to present this? How, like, when you finally got the green light, the merch was done, it was going to happen. What right. Describe that feeling.
It's incredible, man. We've just done a 3 months of touring in Europe. So, you know, we're already back in the saddle, so to say, because, you know, these summer festivals in Europe are just incredible. So we had a blast, and we were able to play some of the new material, but of course not all of it. But now that we're going to do a full-blown headlining show wherever we go in the U.S., we can actually pull more stuff from the new album and also some older deep cuts. And it's going to be quite exciting. We're very excited.
Well, we just got back from Summer Breeze. And yeah. As you say, it's... And for a Canadian or anybody from North America, yeah, there are some big festivals. But when I first walked into Vaucan, for example, like 20 years ago, it's there's nothing that compares to anything in Europe. So to get back after 3 years, it was just like, wow, it was like Christmas morning times 1,000.
Yeah, it really was.
It was.
I love these festivals because, I mean, it's really like, it's another world almost, isn't it? I mean, the festival, the way the people dress, it's just this, you walk into this site of 50,000, 70,000 metal fans, and it's just like heaven in a way. It's almost like it exists in a parallel universe, because it's nowhere else in the world is it quite like that, is it?
No, and I tell people all the time, because they look at the photos and they're like, oh, I can't afford that. You know what? You can afford not going out for lunch once a week, or you do that kind of math and you come up with your $1,000, and it's paid for. It's pretty easy to do if you can budget for it, because it's kind of like the cruise too. It's just like this life-changing experience.
And that's what people are doing more and more, that they don't mind spending a little more if they get something special for it. It seems like, you know, because I remember back in, I don't know, in the 80s, a ticket was always about the same. You know, there weren't tickets that were that expensive, but at the same time, there weren't any special events like cruises or festivals with 50 bands. It just didn't exist back then.
And now, as we age, it's almost like a family vacation, because most of these festivals, like,
Yeah,
gosh,
speak for
there
yourself because I don't age, see, so I don't
are
know. Like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
well, the proof is right there in the photo. Of course you don't age.
I wish, my man. I wish.
But no, but it really is, it's almost like a family vacation, because
I
some of
know.
these festivals stretch out 3, 4 days, and you make a week of it, and you got your kids there. How wonderful is that?
It's amazing. That's another phenomenon of these days that people come multi-generational now. You know, back when I grew up, the last thing you would entertain was the thought of going to a concert with your dad. You know, as a matter of fact, when our parents liked something, it was a definitely no go, and vice versa. We wanted to make music that our parents hated.
Right.
But that's the thing of the past. Nowadays, people are just happily reunited, and families come, you know, with their kids and parents, and it's awesome. It's great.
So talk to me about how Accept actually rehearses, and what's the routine, and what's like the kind of the work day to get prepared for a major tour.
Well, luckily, we've got some very professional guys in the band, and everybody has a super work ethic. So we are quite well prepared when we get together. Everybody knows their parts, everybody knows the songs. So it's just a matter of getting running through the songs a few times until you don't no longer have to think about it. But we don't really do these like month-long rehearsals or anything. We usually go do a week or so, depending on how long we haven't played. Now, like having said that, after this pandemic, the first rehearsal that actually took like several weeks, just because we all have been so out of it and nobody had really done any serious work. You know, because if you when you play at home and practice a little bit on the couch or whatever, it's not the same as when you're standing up and you're singing and you're moving and you're
Right.
bang, 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 a full show. It's quite demanding actually sometimes. So that is an aspect that we needed to get back into, just sort of having the energy to do a full 2-hour show and still feel good about it. Because it's no fun if you're on stage and you feel like exhausted or you have to think about anything. It's beautiful when it all happens automatically, kind of.
Well, it's almost like a sporting event. You've got your teammates, your
That's
musicians, your
right.
players,
Okay.
and you need to own it, right? You gotta, like, you're
Pretty
all there to
much.
own it.
Yeah, you don't want to think about anything on stage. That's my biggest thing. If I'm insecure and I think about, oh, what's gonna come next? What's coming? Oh, how does it go? What the then I already messed up and my mind is not in it. But it's beautiful when it's sort of on autopilot and you can really just enjoy the moment and put all your heart and soul into certain licks and things. And that's fun when you don't have to think about anything anymore. So
Well, I think I told you on 70,000 Tons, you just make it look so effortless. It's like another limb that's a guitar. You know what I mean? It's just natural. You know what I mean? It's wonderful to look at, to watch.
yeah, but like I said, if we haven't played in like 2 years, it feels quite foreign, that object in my hands. It's like, huh? Which, what, where's?
So how does Accept go about choosing a set list? You've got a million albums. It's got to be a fun little chore.
You can never, I mean, one thing is always there. You can't please everybody, and you never have enough time. So you got to make hard choices always. You got to throw some of your babies out, even if you want to keep them, but you have to say, okay, this is more important than that, basically.
Right.
And after all these years, I know quite well which songs people respond to the most or the best, you know. So we're always going to play Princess of the Dawn and Fast as a Shark and songs like that, and Balls to the Wall, of course. But hey, man, if we have a new album out, we want to squeeze as many into the set as we can. But you know, there's two thoughts, because not every it depends on what kind of show it is. Like at festivals, I always think, well, that's a general population. They come to see many bands, and they're not necessarily Accept fans. They don't know all the material. They know maybe some stuff. But when we do our headline shows, I think those are pretty diehard fans. They have the album, they know the material, and then we can afford to play a little more, you know, deep cuts and more stuff from the new album, just because they've heard the other stuff so many times.
Is there any Accept songs that actually don't work live that you get requested?
Yeah, there's some obscure songs that sometimes when the early albums that people say, that's my favorite song, and da, da, da. And sometimes we've tried those during rehearsals, and we go like, meh, Not so much. It was great in the studio, but it doesn't quite gel in the context, you know. It kind of, yeah. When you hear an album or a song by itself, it might sound all right, but in the context of the running order of the show, it kind of, the energy level maybe dips a little bit, or it doesn't quite work right. It's hard to say, but you get a feeling for it after a while.
What do you think the most difficult song is to play live for you?
Tell you, The Undertaker, for instance, a new single that we have, that's not an easy one to play for some reason, but we've got it down quite well, and it's a lot of fun now. But initially, it took us a bit longer than normal, because some songs are just so easy, or like they just fall in place, where others you have to sort of work on them a little bit until they feel right.
Do the classics ever tire? Do you ever get tired? No?
Why is that? Never. They're tired during rehearsals. There's no response. Like a song like Princess of the Dawn, when we just rehearse it, it bores me to tears because there's nothing happening. It's not challenging to play. And it's just sort of, you just go through it because you have to do it. So you memorize all the parts. But when it's live, it's one of the best songs there is and one of the most fun songs to play because of the audience reaction. They always love that song, and it's got to just about the right tempo for everybody to lock in, and then there's this sort of audience response in the chorus, and it's one of the funnest songs we have, I think, live.
That's the one key, the audience, right?
Well, yeah, because we're not doing the show for us, we're doing the show for the audience to please them, and it's this back and forth, you know. Without the audience participation, it's only half the thing. It's really just, yeah. That's why we didn't do any of these, what do you call them, during the pandemic. Everybody did these
live things.
Well, the fake live shows without audience. What did you call them again? I forget.
Just streaming events, right?
Streaming events. There you go.
Yeah.
Because I figured, like, that's got to be terrible. You play into a camera, and you get no feedback at all after the song is over. When the song is over, or during these sing-along parts, it's just dead silence.
It's like the mic drop.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, how much fun would that be?
What? Is anyone hearing? Anybody listening?
Yeah. Anybody out there?
When was the last time an audience, like, truly blew your mind, and where was it? That just, like, whoa, this is, like, the greatest audience ever.
Just recently, we played a fantastic gig in Barcelona at the festival there. It was really one of the best we've done all summer long. Because, you know, Southern Europeans and South American audiences, they're hot-blooded and they're wild. And they love to sing along to our stuff. And it's just fantastic.
Nice.
I mean, they're really, really great audience. You know.
Now, there was a big change when it comes to guitars with Accept. You kind of pulled an Iron Maiden and you brought now three on board, right? That's that obviously is a huge, huge change.
Yeah, it's not as big of a change as you think. I think it just adds something. It's I wasn't so sure how it's going to work initially. I'll tell you what happened. We did this orchestra tour in 2019, I think. And our guitar player, Uwe, wasn't available for that tour. So we found Phil Schaus, a guitar player from Nashville, who happened to be a friend of our drummer, Christopher Williams. They played together in the past many times. So anyhow, he sat in for all these shows, and we discovered what a fantastic player he is and how well we get along on a personal level and also musically. And when the tour was over, we thought it would be a shame to send him back home. So we decided, why can't we just have three guitar players in the band? And then we went through all the catalog and found parts for everybody to play. And it's a blast. I think it sounds 10 times better. It's great.
Wow. Nice. Very nice.
Yeah. It really adds something, you know.
And you got your look, like the leathers, not that they ever went away, but just you look metal. And I know that, like, you're a huge Priest fan, and I was reading Halford's biography a few months ago and how they finally got on the leathers, and that must have been a big influence when you saw these bands in the 70s
yeah
playing heavy metal but dressing heavy metal.
Right.
And what's going through your mind with stage attire these days?
Yeah, it went through changes a little bit. Yeah, you're right. And initially in the 70s and 80s, it was real leather. And the first band that I ever noticed doing it was indeed Judas Priest. And
right.
We actually opened up for Judas Priest in 1980, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Awesome. And that influenced us a lot because actually I remember walking by their dressing room and everything. You know, they have this crew guy like putting leather lotion or what do you call it, this conditioner on the stuff, and everything smelled like leather even just walking by their dressing room. Right. So, and we needed to have leather too, so we all, you know, and it was really hard to find stuff like that back then, and sometimes we even really went into the porn stores, like the gay outfit stores, just to buy like a leather vest, or even the belts were hard to find in those days, you know.
So the Reaper Bond.
The Reaper, but yeah, those kind of places in Hamburg at the, and you can still find cool clothing there, by the way.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then let's see what happened. So we wore leather, and then it was a time of spandex. Everybody discovered spandex, including us. And yeah, that's not maybe the best look for nowadays.
What's the most comfortable? On
that screen? Is the most comfortable because it's basically like pantyhose if you think about it.
Right. Well, and Priest probably influenced that again when they released Turbo, right? All these stage get-ups started.
Yeah, that went a little. Yeah, then it all went a little too far, I thought, in the 80s, late 80s, when especially the hair time when everybody was starting to look so pretty. And we fell into that for a little while, but looking back at it, it was too much, I thought.
Jakey Lee told me a really funny story because Metallica, during Master of Puppets, that was when they started to really break because they were opening up for Ozzy. And Sharon told Ozzy and Jake and the whole band that, like, you never dress like the punters because Metallica would come out there with their jeans and their cutoff t-shirts.
Right.
Sharon's like, no, no, no. So that's why Ozzy was so glammed up. And Jake was like, well, I guess I have to do that. So never dress like the punters, according to Sharon.
That's right. That was the motto back then. You didn't want to. Yeah, exactly. Of course, it has changed now dramatically. And basically nowadays, whatever you feel like, I mean, there's no dress code anymore at all.
I had a conversation with Charlie Benante a couple of weeks ago, and he credits his entire speed metal drumming on two things, Fast as a Shark and Filthy Animal. So really accept created speed metal at the end of the day. How do you view that when people talk about the influence of Fast as a Shark? Because that was a pretty damn fast song for its time. And where did come from? Where did the need for speed come from?
It was just born out of fun and a little bit of shock value. Like I said earlier, we wanted to shock parents and we wanted to have a little bit of a shock value with anything we did. And our drummer, Stefan Kaufmann, at the time, he was all into that, you know, the more extreme, the better. And so he actually came up with that idea for that, you know, song initially. Right. And then we finished writing it together. I contributed to the intro and the chorus but it was all basically, there was no deep meaning, or we didn't think it was going to be anything that special as it later on turned out to be, you know, and we kind of left it alone after that. It was until years later, people all told us what a huge influence that song had on their career or on, yeah, the music scene in general. Back in those days, we weren't aware of it at all. You know, we just released that song and we liked it. It was great and it did what it did, but we didn't think much of it other than that. You know, we didn't really want to start a whole genre or anything. And we didn't want to take it to more extremes and more extremes and start. But it's a huge honor to find out that later on it influenced so many people. It's amazing, isn't it?
Did you ever reflect, because obviously heavy metal got really, really heavy in the early 80s with the Big Four, and you keep going into the late 80s with all the death metal, and then you're like going, wow, we were doing it pretty fast a few years ago. Were you paying attention to Metallica's Kill 'Em All or the Megadeth or the Slayer records at the time? I'm like, whoa, we caused this.
Yeah, in a way, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's totally amazing. Were you a fan? Were you paying attention, or was it just full on accept, nothing else?
In general, I don't pay that much attention to the music scene and other bands, to be honest. I'm pretty much in my own little bubble and worry about my own business and accept stuff and so forth. And sometimes on purpose, because sometimes I think the more I listen to and the more I see what other people are doing, the more it might influence me. And I'm really trying to hold on to any originality that we have or our own style. So, and I think if you there's always a certain danger if you listen to everything that you want to, whether you notice it or not. I think you absorb something from everybody, and then maybe our own style would reflect that too much, you know. So I'm trying to stay away from too much metal, other metal music, to be honest.
Can we reminisce for a little bit? Just bounce around with your past. Do you
Yeah,
mind?
no.
The I find one particular record. Everyone focuses on Balls to the Wall, and of course that and rest like lots of highlights with your catalog. But I find sonically, Metal Heart and what you did with Dieter Dierks is it really is from start to finish this epic, most pristine, most beautiful sounding metal record.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you.
It really is. It's just something about the clarity of, especially the title track. I thought Screaming for a Love Bite would have resonated more as a hit. And the album was a hit, but I was like thinking at the time, man, this should have been a bigger hit. Did you guys get that feeling? It was all about radio back
It
then,
was
right?
all about radio, and everybody, including us, wanted to be on the radio with at least one song. That was sort of the ticket. And everybody you talk to would tell you the same thing. All the labels, the producers, everybody would say, man, if we only had one song that was catchy enough for you to be able to land on the radio. And I guess Screaming for a Love Bite was that attempt in a way, you know.
Yeah, beautiful chorus line, but maybe it was just Udo's. It's the voice has a lot to do with it, right?
Oh,
Unfortunately,
God.
it's a classic song, but it's for some people, especially if you're older, it's like, oh, that's just a little noisy and too grainy.
Right. I agree. This just wasn't meant to be. And also, looking back, I think we always had this extra difficulty being from Germany. If you think about it, most super successful acts were British or American in that genre. You know, who? I mean, there's the Scorpions, but I mean, being from Germany, it puts you in the, I don't know, in the far corner somewhere. Somehow, you're somehow not part of the club, you know, with a singer like Udo and German, and this is whole. There's a different vibe that you don't really didn't really fit in the club, so to say.
I spoke to Rudolf Schenker, and he brought up something. It's and you're right. Being from Germany, and he flagged all the World War II stuff. You know what I mean? And he said the Scorpions, they just wanted to put all that behind us and just write
Yeah.
some great music and tour everywhere,
Right.
absolutely everywhere. Did you get that feeling at all?
Absolutely. That's why we sang in English and not in German. Because because people always ask us, now there's a lot of bands performing and super successful acts in Germany, singing in German, like Rammstein being one of them. And
Right.
people ask something, why didn't you do that too? Well, in those days, we all thought we want to tour internationally, and you have to speak English. You have to have, you know, compete with the big boys and be on the radio, be on MTV, and you better have English lyrics. Absolutely. We always wanted to do tour worldwide, and we wanted to get out of Germany and see the world. You know, we were just, I don't know, 16, 17-year-old boys in a rehearsal room in Solingen, in Wuppertal, and thinking maybe one day we get to see other countries, and maybe one day we can live from making music. It was a dream that we all had, but my gosh, it was so far away. So, you know, and we didn't know how far we could take it ever. And to have actually come out of Germany and tour the world, tour America, and you know, here we are 40 years later talking about it. It's amazing
It's a
if you think
huge,
about it. I mean, it's what are the chances of that ever coming to fruition?
right. It's the ultimate lottery win, right?
It kind of is. Sometimes you have to remind yourself, because here's the thing, as musicians, you always That's what bothers me a lot of times. And musicians love to complain about, oh my God, the travel is so and this and oh man, I'm working so hard. But really, we're living the dream if you think about it. Sure. If you really are able to sustain yourself and make a living by doing what you love, that's a lottery win right there. Right. You know. So
well, since you brought it up, how did you learn English then in Germany? Was it a requirement in public school that everyone had to take English at the same time?
Yes, we all learned English, but mostly grammar, and nobody taught us to speak and have a conversation. So I was able to read and understand and all that, but it's still a different thing. It's different from having a conversation. And I remember,
sure.
I remember we were scheduled to do our first ever interview in English with the BBC. I think it was Peter and I. So we went in and it was sort of a very understanding guy. He was very patient with us and he asked us one question and very, so how did it all start? And I'm sitting there going like, fuck, I don't know. I can't do this. I basically walked out of there and gave up because I was so nervous and I couldn't find the right words. It's hard initially. And then when we went on tour in America in 84 for the first time, then that's when you had to talk to everybody and it got better after that.
When you read stories about the Beatles or the Stones or you name any band that they finally got to America.
Right.
Although, you know what? I'm not a big fan of the term America because it's called North America. And in the north,
sorry,
it's in the south, it's called the United States. But anyways, when you got to America, what was the feeling of getting to America, sailing to America?
Oh my God, that was a dream. Because first of all, you've never been that far away from home ever. You know, like an 8 hour, 10 hour flight, and other side of the world. That was amazing enough. But then to see all these places for the first time, New York and LA, and my God, it was amazing. Really amazing, an eye-opening experience. And then the first tour we went on was Kiss. So that was quite a big jump from playing venues in Europe and then going on tour with Kiss. It was amazing, really amazing, eye-opening experience.
And it's not just about the culture. It's like this is now big business. You know what I mean? There's budgets, there's labels, there's like all that stuff was part of that. And it's all coming at you at once.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I have to tell you, in those days, I was quite young still, and everybody in the band was super young, and it all was in the beginning of the whole, I don't know, metal scene. You know, they always talk about the glorious 80s, but it really was an amazing time. But I almost didn't have time to reflect on it and to really appreciate it for what it was, because everything happened quite fast and you sort of almost took it for granted in a way.
Right.
I didn't value it until much later, you know, and like they always say, you never know what you got until it's gone.
Right.
And then when the 90s came around and everything turned south from the whole metal scene, including us, then you realize, oh shit, it was pretty, pretty great while it was happening back in those days, you know.
But there's some,
that's sorry, why I'm super happy now for these last 10 years. I'm really, I know, almost humble and can really appreciate it so much more. Having stepped away from everything and now coming back and doing this again, it's amazing. It's awesome.
Yeah, and it wasn't like there was like one fluke album. Like this is like a second coming of Accept, and it's been, as you say, 10 years. That's
right. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, we made 5 albums. I think this is a very consistent and very fruitful period in our lives. And yeah, I'm totally aware of it, and I really appreciate every moment of it. Really do.
And where would you like to take this? What's left to conquer?
I don't think there's the one thing that we haven't done yet that I would love to do. I mean, I wouldn't mind a Nobel Prize for heavy metal, but that ain't gonna happen. No, I don't think there's anything I just want to keep doing what we're doing and maybe get a bit better at what we're doing. You know, maybe play bigger venues and that sort of thing. But that's just a gradual increment of what's happening already. So I just want to do what we're doing, bring the metal around the world as we're doing right now.
Is there any place that you haven't played yet that's in a particular
Yeah, that's too
country?
bad. Yeah, India, China, Africa. I haven't been to any of those places. So there's still corners of the world we haven't been to.
And by the looks of you, your fitness routine and diet and everything, it's, you know what I mean? Like going on stage for 90 minutes is like playing a football soccer game, right? It takes a lot of energy and you can't be any kind of slouch. So what's in the fountain of youth for you and your daily routine and regime?
Nothing much, really. I mean, nothing special, I'd say. I take care of myself. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't take drugs. So, I mean, those kind of things, they backfire after a while. And I don't know. I just go to the gym and stay reasonably. I watch what I eat, that sort of thing. It's just all common sense, really.
And
Nothing.
how is Florida life versus German life?
Pretty good. Pretty laid back, and weather is a whole lot better. You know, and currently here, I'm in Nashville right now.
Right.
But Florida is quite nice too, I have to say. It's really beautiful, the weather down there. Oh my God. Especially in the wintertime. It's the place to be.
That's where I'm hoping that Brave Words will be relocated at some point in time.
Well, are you thinking about it? Excellent.
Absolutely.
Great.
Yes.
I don't blame
Yeah.
you. Yeah, the older I get, the less I like the cold, you know. There used to be a time when I really didn't mind snow and freezing cold. I kind of loved it. But now, not so much.
No, I'll take the extreme heat over the extreme cold any day, and I'm
Same here.
right. It's
Yeah. You're
absolutely
from
nasty.
Canada. You're supposed to love
I know, but I'm in my 50s, and I'd rather skate on it than deal with it, if you know what I mean.
it. I don't blame you.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation, and can't wait to see you. Actually, I've got the flyer here. There's the Phoenix show. Yes, coming up.
Please. And let's not forget to promote the tour, please.
Yes,
Please
absolutely.
go. Go to
Yes.
acceptworldwide.com. There's the camera. Let me point that there. Acceptworldwide.com. You see all the tour dates there. Please come in hordes. And we also have a VIP thingy if you're interested in doing that. So we'd love to see you backstage with cool gifts and all kinds of stuff. So please hope to see you there.